natural to him as teaching. I decided on a deep nod. Curtsies often tipped me over. We came to the parrot cages, my other favorite place. The birds spoke all the languages of the earth, human foreign tongues, and the exotic tongues of Gnomic, Elfian, Ogurese, and Abdegi, the language of the giants. I loved to imitate them, even though I didn't know what they were saying. Simon, their keeper, was my friend. When he saw Char, he bowed low. Then he returned to feeding an orange bird.
"This one's new," he said. "Speaks Gnomic and doesn't shut up. Futh tour if tug brzee, erg yim a butch. If tug brzee," the parrot said.
"Futh tour if tug brzee, erth yim butch, if tug brzee," I repeated.
"You speak Gnomic," Char said.
I like to make the sounds. I only know what a few words mean.
"She does it just right, doesn't she, Your Highness?"
"Futh tour if tug brzee."
Char gave up.
"It sounded better when you did it."
"Akto di is apuz ukodvak,"
the parrot squawked. "Do you know what he said?" I asked Simon, who was able to translate occasionally. Simon shook his head.
"Do you know, sir?"
"No, it sounds like gargling."
Other visitors claimed Simon's attention.
"Excuse me," he said.
Char watched while I said farewell to each bird.
"Ikwo puwetch. Brzee uf gee."
That was Gnomic for "until we dig again."
"Antun sing,"
Ogurese for "much eating."
"Aee oo, big ow,"
Abdegi for "I miss you already."
"Poor ol pes wadu,"
Elfian for "walk in the shade." I memorized the sight of the birds and Simon. "Goodbye," I called. He waved. Lest they be frightened out of their feathers, a garden separated the birds from the ogres. We passed beds of flowers while I tried to teach Char a few of the words he'd just heard. His memory was good, but his accent was unalterably Kyrian.
"If they heard me, the elves would never let me stand under a tree again."
"The gnomes would hit you over the head with a shovel."
"Would the ogres decide I was unworthy of consumption?"
We neared their hut. Even though they were locked in, soldiers were posted within our range. An ogre glared at us through a window. Ogres weren't dangerous only because of their size and their cruelty. They knew your secrets just by looking at you, and they used their knowledge. When they wanted to be, they were irresistibly persuasive. By the end of an ogre's first sentence in Kyrian, you forgot his pointy teeth, the dried blood under his fingernails, and the coarse black hair that grew on his face in clumps. He became handsome in your eyes, and you thought him your best friend. By the end of the second sentence, you were so won over that he could do whatever he wanted with you. Drop you in a pot to cook, or, if he was in a hurry, eat you raw.
"Pwich awe zikoek,"
a soft, lisping voice said. "Did you hear that?" I asked.
"Doesn't sound like an ogre. Where did it come from?"
"Pwich awe zuak,"
the voice repeated, this time with a hint of tears in its tones. A toddler gnome poked his head out of an aqueduct, only a few feet from the hut. I saw him at the same moment the ogre did. He could reach the child through the unglazed window. I started for the boy, but Char was quicker. He snatched him up just before the ogre's arm shot out. Char backed away, holding the youngster, who squirmed to get out of his grasp. "Give him to me," I said, thinking I might be able to quiet him. Char handed him over.
"See, fra mein," the ogre hissed, glaring at Char. "Min sin zee, min thus forns."
Then he turned to me, and his expression changed. He started laughing.
"Moo, nga, sus, jin, imong, mein, wad zee, unu. Zee aortha, kaj eeth sif zee."
Tears of mirth streaked down his cheeks, leaving trails on his filthy face. Then he said in Kyrian, not bothering to make his voice persuasive,
"Come to me and bring the child."
I stood my ground. Now I had to break the curse. My life and another's depended on it. My knees began to tremble from the need to walk. I held back, and my muscles cramped, shooting pain through my calves. I squeezed the little gnome in my effort to resist, and he yelped and twisted in my arms. The ogre continued to laugh. Then he spoke again. Obey me this instant. Come now. Against my will, I took a step. I stopped, and the trembling started again. Another step and another. I saw nothing except that leering face, looming closer and closer. Chapter 7 "Where are you going?" Char cried. He could see where I was going. "I must," I said. "Stop! I command you to stop!" I stopped and stood shaking, while soldiers crowded around the hut, their swords pointed at the ogre, who glared at me, then turned his back and retreated into the dim interior. "Why did you listen to him?" Char asked. I was still having trouble with the child. He was pulling his little beard and wriggling to escape. "Pewitch Azuk Fritch!" he cried. I used his distress to avoid answering the question. He's frightened. But Char wasn't distracted. Why did you listen to him, Ella? I had to answer. Somehow. His eyes, I lied. Something about them. I had to do what he wanted. Have they found a new way to bewitch us? Char sounded alarm. I must tell my father. The gnome child wailed, thrashing at the air. I wondered if the parrot's words might soothe him. I spoke them, hoping they weren't an insult. "Fwith chor, if tug brise, earth yam boich, if tug brise." The child's face cleared, and he smiled, showing pearly baby teeth. "Fwith tor, if tug brise, earth yam boich, if tug brise," he repeated. There was a dimple in the folds of wrinkles and baby fat. I put him down, and he took my hand in Char's. "His parents must be worried," I said. I didn't know how to ask him where they were, and he was probably too young to answer. They weren't by the ferocious beasts, or by the grazing animals. At last we spied an ancient female gnome sitting on the ground near the pond. Her head was between her knees, an image of defeat. Other gnomes searched the reeds and hedges, or questioned passers-by. "Frigrum!" the little gnome cried, pulling at Char and me. The old gnome looked up, her face wet with tears. "Zulf!" she grabbed him in a tight hug and covered his face and beard with kisses. Then she peered at us and recognized Char. "Highness, thank you for the return of my grandson." Char coughed, an embarrassed sound. "We're glad to bring him back, madam," he said. "He was almost an ogre's lunch." "Char! Prince Charmant saved him," I said. "And saved me, too." "You have the gratitude of the gnomes," the gnome bowed her head. "I am Zetaf." Hardly taller than I, she was much wider. Not stout, but wide. Which is the direction gnomes grow after they reach adulthood. She was the most dignified personage I had ever seen. And the oldest. Except for Mandy, probably. Her wrinkles had wrinkles. Small folds and deeper folds of leathery skin. Her eyes were deep set, and their copper color was clouded. I curtsied and wobbled. "I'm Ella," I said. More gnomes came, and we were surrounded. "How did you persuade him to come with you?" Zetaf said. "He would not go with most humans." "Ella spoke to him," Char said, sounding proud of me. "What did you say?" I hesitated. It was one thing to imitate parrots for Simon, or to speak to a baby. It was another to sound like a fool in front of this stately lady. "Fwith chor if tug brise earth yamabok if tug brise," I said finally. "No wonder he came with you," Zetaf said.
"Freck!"
Zulf cried joyously. He squirmed in her arms. A younger gnome woman took the child. "Where did you learn to speak gnomic?" she asked. "I'm Zulf's mother." I explained about the parrots. "What did I say to Zulf?"
"It's an expression. We say it as a greeting," Zetaf said. "In Kyrian, it's digging is good for the wealth and good for the health."
She held her hand out to me.
"Zulf is not the only one you will save. I see it."
What else could she see? Mandy had said a few gnomes could tell the future. Can you see what's ahead for me? Gnomes do not see detail. What you will wear tomorrow, what you will say, are mysteries. I see outlines only. What are they? Danger, a quest, three figures. They are close to you, but they are not your friends. She let my hand go. Beware of them. On our way out of the menagerie, Char said,
Tonight I shall triple the guard around the ogres, and soon I shall catch a centaur and give it to you.
Dame Olga was punctual. She and her daughters watched while my trunk and a barrel of tonic were loaded on top of the coach. Father was there to see me off, and Mandy stood at a distance.
How few things you have, Hattie told me.
Dame Olga agreed.
Ella is not outfitted in accordance with her station, Sir Peter. My girls have 8 trunks between them.
Hattie has 5.5 trunks, Mother, and I have only... Olive stopped speaking to count on her fingers.
Less. I have less, and it's not fair.
Father cut in smoothly.
It's most kind of you to take Ella with you, Dame Olga. I only hope she won't be a bother.
Oh, she won't bother me, Sir P. I'm not going.
Father winced at the abbreviation. Dame Olga continued.
With a coachman and 2 footmen, they will be safe from everything except ogres, and from ogres I could offer little protection. Besides, they'll have more fun without their old mother.
After a pause, Father said,
Not old. Never old, madame.
He turned to me.
I wish you a comfortable journey, child.
He kissed my cheek.
I'll miss you.
Liar. A footman opened the coach door. Hattie and Olive were handed in. I ran to Mandy. I couldn't leave without a last hug.
Make them all disappear, please, I whispered. Oh, Ella, sweetie, you'll be fine.
She clasped me hard.
Eleanor, your friends are waiting, Father called.
I climbed into the coach, stowing a small carpet bag in a corner, and we started to move. For comfort, I touched my chest where Mother's necklace was concealed. If she were alive, I wouldn't be rolling away from home in the company of these creatures.
I would never embrace a cook, Hattie shuddered.
No, I agreed. What cook would let you? Hattie returned to an earlier subject.
With so few belongings, the other girls will hardly know whether you are a servant or one of us.
Why does your gown pucker in front? Olive asked.
Is that a necklace?
Why wear it under your clothes?
Hattie asked. Is it ugly? Olive said. Is that why you hide it?
It's not ugly. Show it to us. Holly and I so want to see it.
An order. I brought it out. It didn't matter here. There were no thieves to steal it.
Ooh, Olive said. It's even nicer than Mama's best chain.
No one would think you were a servant with that. It's very fine, although it's much too long for you.
Hattie fingered the silver ropes.
Olive, see how milky the pearls are?
Olive's fingers joined Hattie's. Let go! I shifted out of their reach.
We won't hurt it. May I try it on? Mother lets me try on her necklaces, and I never hurt them.
No, you can't.
Oh, let me. There's a dear.
An order. Do I have to? I asked. It slipped out. I could have swallowed my tongue. Hattie's eyes glittered.
Yes, you have to. Give it over.
Just for a minute, I said, unclasping it. I didn't delay. They mustn't see me struggle against the curse.
Fasten it around my neck.
I did so.
Olive.
The order had been for her sister.
Thank you, my dear.
Hattie settled back in her seat.
I was born to wear jewels like this.
Let me try it, Ella, Olive said.
When you're older, Hattie answered.
But I had to obey. I tried desperately to ignore Olive's order, but all my complaints started. Churning stomach, pounding temples, shortness of breath.
Let her have her turn, I said, through clenched teeth. See, Olive said. Ella says I can.
I know it's best for you, Olive. You and Ella are both too young.
I lunged at her and unfastened the necklace before she had time to stop me.
Don't give it to her, Ella, Hattie said. Return it to me.
I did.
Give it to me, Ella, Olive said, her voice rising. Don't be so mean, Hattie.
I snatched the necklace back from Hattie and passed it to Olive. Hattie stared at me. I could see her start to work out what had happened. Mother wore that necklace to her wedding, I said, hoping to deflect her thoughts. And her mother.
Are you always so obedient, Ella?
Return the necklace to me.
I won't let her, Olive said.
Yes, you will, or I'll see that you get no dinner tonight. I took the necklace away from Olive. Hattie fastened it around her neck and patted it complacently.
Ella, you should give it to me. It would be a token of our friendship.
We're not friends.
Yes, we are. I'm devoted to you. Olive likes you too, don't you, Ollie?
Olive nodded solemnly.
I believe you will give it to me if I say you must.
Do so, Ella, for friendship's sake.
You must.
No, I wouldn't. She couldn't have it. You can have it! The words burst from me.
Thank you! Oh, what a generous friend we have, Olive.
She changed the subject. The servants were careless when they cleaned the coach. That dust ball is a disgrace. We shouldn't have to ride in such filth. Pick it up, Ella. An order I liked. I grabbed the dust and ground it into her face. It becomes you, I said. But the satisfaction was fleeting.
Chapter 8.
Hattie didn't know about Lucinda and the curse, but she understood I always had to follow her orders. After I rubbed dust in her face, all she did was smile. The smile meant that dust weighed little in the balance of her power. I retreated to a corner of the coach and gazed out the window. Hattie hadn't ordered me not to take the necklace back again. What if I lifted it over her large head, or what if I yanked it off her neck? It would be better broken than owned by her. I tried. I told my arms to move, told my hands to grasp, but the curse wouldn't let me. If someone else had ordered me to take it back, I would have had to. But I couldn't will myself to reclaim it. And so I made myself look at it, to become accustomed to the sight. While I stared, Hattie stroked the chain, gloating. In a few minutes, her eyes closed. Her mouth fell open, and she began to snore. Olive crossed the carriage to sit next to me.
I want a present to show we're friends, too, she said.
Why don't you give me a gift instead? The furrows in her forehead deepened.
No, you give me.
An order. What would you like? I asked.
I want money. Give me money.
As he'd promised, Father had given me a purse of silver KJs. I reached into my carpet bag and pulled out a coin. Here you are. Now we're friends. She spat on the coin and rubbed it to make it shine.
We're friends, she agreed.
She crossed back to her former seat and brought the coin close to her eyes to study it. I looked at the snoring Hattie. She was probably dreaming of ways to order me about. I looked at Olive, who was running the edge of the KJ over her forehead and down her nose. I began to long for finishing school. At least there they wouldn't be my only companions. In a few minutes, Olive joined Hattie in slumber. When I was certain both of them were soundly asleep, I dared to fetch Mandy's other present, the book of fairy tales, out of my bag. I turned away from the two of them to hide the book and to catch the light from the carriage window. When I opened it, instead of a fairy tale, I found an illustration of Mandy. She was dicing a turnip. Next to the turnip was the chicken I had watched her pluck that morning. She was crying. I had suspected she was fighting back tears when she hugged me. The page blurred because my eyes filled with tears, too. But I refused to cry in front of Hattie and Olive, even if they were asleep. If Mandy had been in the coach with me, she would have hugged me, and I could have cried as long as I liked. She would have patted my back and told me, "No, those thoughts would make me cry." If Mandy were here, she'd tell me why it would be big, bad magic to turn Hattie into a rabbit, and I'd wonder again what fairies were good for. That helped. I checked to make sure they were still sleeping. Then I examined the next page. It showed a room that probably was in King Gerald's castle, because Char was there, and the crest of Kyria was painted on the wall above a tapestry. Char was talking to three of the soldiers who had been in the ogre's guard at the menagerie. I puzzled about the meaning. Maybe an explanation would follow. I turned the page and found two more illustrations. Neither one of Char or soldiers. On the verso was a map of Frau. There was our manor, bearing the legend, Sir Peter of Frau. My fingers traced the route to the old castle and onto the menagerie. There was the south road out of Frau, the road we were on now, far beyond the map's boundaries, far beyond the manor of Sir Peter of Frau. The right-hand illustration showed Father's coach, followed by three mule-drawn wagons, loaded with goods for trade. Father sat atop the coach, with the driver, who was plying his whip. Father leaned into the wind and grinned. What would the book show me next? A real fairy tale this time, the shoemaker and the elves. In this version, though, each elf had a personality, and I came to know them better than the shoemaker. And I finally understood why the elves disappeared after the shoemaker made clothes for them. They went away to help a giant rid herself of a swarm of mosquitoes, too small for her to see. Although the elves left a thank you note for the shoemaker, he put his coffee cup down on it, and it stuck to the cup's damp bottom. The story made sense now. Your book must be fascinating. Let me see it, Hattie said. I jumped. If she took this from me, too, I'd kill her. The book got heavier as I handed it over. Her eyes widened as she read. You enjoy this? The life cycle of the centaur tick? She turned pages. Gnomish silver mining in hazardous terrain? Isn't it interesting, I said, my panic subsiding. You can read for a while. If we're going to be friends, we should have the same interests. You can share my interests, dear. She returned the book. Our journey taught me what to expect from Hattie. At the inn on our first night, she informed me I had taken the space in their carriage that would otherwise have been occupied by their maid. But we shan't suffer, because you can take her place. She cocked her head to one side. No, you are almost noble. It would be an insult to make a servant of you. You will be my lady-in-waiting, and I shall share you with my sister sometimes. Ollie, is there something Ella can do to help you? No, I can dress and undress myself, Olive said defiantly. No one said you can't. Hattie sat on the bed we were all to share. She lifted her feet. Kneel down and take my slippers off for me, Ella. My toes ache. Without comment, I removed them. My nose filled with the ripe smell of her feet. I carried the slippers to the window and tossed them out. Hattie yawned. You've only made extra work for yourself. Go down and fetch them. Olive rushed to the window. Your slippers fell into a bucket of slaps. I had to carry the stinking slippers back to our room. But Hattie had to wear them until she was able to get fresh ones from her trunk. After that, she thought more carefully about her commands. At breakfast the next morning, she pronounced the porridge inedible. Don't eat it, Ella. It will make you sick. She loaded her spoon with oatmeal. Steam rose from the bowl before me, and I caught the scent of cinnamon. Mandy always put cinnamon in her porridge, too. Why are you eating it if it's bad? Olive asked her sister. I'm hungry. Yours looks all right. I'm eating mine, even though it's vile. Her tongue licked a speck of cereal off the corner of her mouth. Because I need nourishment to take charge on our journey. You're not in Olive began. You don't fancy your porridge, miss? The innkeeper sounded worried. My sister's stomach is queasy, Hattie said. You may take her bowl away. I'm not her sister, I said, as the innkeeper disappeared into the kitchen. Hattie laughed, scraping her spoon around her empty bowl for the last remnants of porridge. The innkeeper was back with a plate of thick brown bread studded with nuts and raisins. Perhaps this will tempt the lass's stomach, he said. I managed to take a big bite before a lady at the next table called him away. Put it down, Ella. Hattie broke off a corner of the bread and tasted it. It's much too rich. Rich food is good for me, Olive said, reaching across the table. Between them, my breakfast disappeared in 4 bites. That swallow of bread was the last food I had on our 3-day trip, except for tonic. Hattie would have deprived me of it, too, except she sampled it first, and then I relished her nauseated expression when she swallowed. Chapter 9. We passed through rich farmland on the final day of our journey to Jen, the town where our finishing school was located. The day was hazy and warm, and I was almost too hot to be hungry. Hattie had energy for only one command, to fan her.
"Fan me too," Olive said. She had worked out that if Hattie told me to do something, I would do it, and if she directed me to do the same thing, I would do that too.
Hattie hadn't explained my obedience to her. She didn't bother to explain much to the slow-thinking Olive, and she must have enjoyed keeping the delicious secret to herself. My arms ached, my stomach rumbled. I stared out the window at a flock of sheep and wished for a diversion that would take my mind away from lamb and lentil salad. My wish was granted instantly as the coach took off in a mad gallop. "Ogres!" the coachman yelled. A cloud of dust hid the road behind us. Through it, I made out a band of ogres, kicking up the dust as they chased us. But we were outdistancing them. The cloud was receding.
"Why do you run from your friends?" one of them called.
It was the sweetest voice I'd ever heard. "We bear gifts of your heart's desires. Riches, love, eternal life." Heart's desire? Mother, the ogres would bring her back from death. Why were we tearing away from everything we most wanted?
"Slow down," Hattie ordered unnecessarily.
The coachman had already reined in the horses. The ogres were only yards behind. Untouched by their magic, the sheep were baaing and bleating their fear. Briefly, their noise covered the honeyed words and the spell broke. I remembered that the ogres couldn't revive Mother. The horses were again whipped to a gallop. But the ogres would be beyond the sheep in a minute, and we'd be at their mercy again. I shouted to Hattie and Olive, and to the coachman and footman, "Yell so you can't hear them!" The coachman understood first, and joined my voice with his, shouting words I'd never heard before. Then Hattie began.
"Eat me last! Eat me last!" she shrieked.
But it was Olive who saved us. Her wordless roar drowned out thought. I don't know how she drew breath. The sound was unending. It continued as we passed the outlying homes of Jen, while the ogres faded from sight, and while I recovered from my fright.
"Quiet, Ollie," Hattie said. "Nobody is going to be eaten. You're giving me a headache."
But Olive didn't hush until the coachman stopped the carriage, came inside with us, and slapped her smartly across the face. "Sorry, miss," he said, and popped back out. Finishing school was in an ordinary wooden house. Except for its enormous ornamental shrubs, pruned into the shapes of wide-skirted maidens, it might have been the home of any not-so-prosperous merchant. I hoped the lunch portions were generous. The door opened as we drove up, and an erect, gray-haired lady strutted down the walkway to our carriage.
"Welcome, young ladies."
She swept into the smoothest curtsy I'd ever seen. We curtsied in return. She waved a hand at me.
"But who is this?"
I spoke quickly, before Hattie could explain me in a way I didn't want to be explained. "I'm Ella, madame. My father's Sir Peter Frell. He wrote a letter. From my carpet bag, I extracted father's letter and the purse he'd given me." She tucked the letter and the purse, after weighing it expertly in her palm, into her apron pocket.
"What a lovely surprise. I'm Madame Edith, headmistress of your new home. Welcome to our humble establishment."
She curtsied again. I wished she'd stop. My right knee cracked when I went down.
"We just had lunch."
So much for generous portions.
"And we are sitting down to our embroidery. The young ladies are anxious to meet you, and it's never too soon to start being finished."
She ushered us into a large, sunny room.
"Young ladies," she announced, "here are three new friends for you."
A room full of maidens rose, curtsied, then resumed their seats. Each one wore a pink gown with a yellow hair ribbon. My gown was stained and wrinkled from the journey, and my hair was probably limp and unkempt.
"Back to work, ladies,"
Madam Edith said.
"Sewing mistress will help the new pupils."
I lowered myself into a chair near the door, and stared defiantly at the elegance around me. I met the eyes of a girl about my age. She smiled hesitantly. Maybe my look softened, because her smile grew, and she winked. Sewing mistress approached, bearing a needle, an assortment of colored thread, and a round of white linen marked with a design of flowers. I was to follow the outline and stitch the flowers in thread. The cloth could then cover a pillow or the back of a chair. After she explained what to do, sewing mistress left me, assuming I would know how to do it. But I had never before held a needle. Although I watched the other girls, I could not thread it. I struggled for a quarter hour till sewing mistress rushed to my side.
"The child has been raised by ogres or worse," she exclaimed, snatching it away from me. "Hold it delicately. It's not a spear. One brings the thread to it."
She threaded the needle with green thread and returned it to me. I held it delicately, as ordered. She left my side, and I stared stupidly at my task. Then I stuck the needle into the outline of a rose. My head ached from lack of food. "You have to knot the end of the thread and start underneath." The speaker was the lass who had winked at me. She had pulled her chair next to mine. "And sewing mistress will ridicule you if you sew a green rose. Roses have to be red or pink, or yellow if you're daring." A pink gown similar to the one she wore was spread across her lap. She bent her head over to make a tiny stitch. Her dark hair was plaited into many braids that were gathered and woven into a knot high on her head. Her skin was the color of cinnamon, with a tint of raspberry in her cheeks. I couldn't help thinking of food. Her lips curved up naturally, giving her a pleased and contented air. Her name was Arida, and her family lived in Amanta, a city just over the border in Ayurtha. She spoke with an Ayurthian accent, smacking her lips after the letter M and pronouncing her L's as Y's. "Abensu utiu anja abensu." I hoped this was Ayurthian for "I'm pleased to meet you." I had learned it from a parrot. She smiled at me ecstatically. "Abensu aikomo Ayurtha?" "I only know a few words," I confessed. She was miserably disappointed. It would have been so nice to have someone to talk to in my language.
"You could teach me."
"Your accent is good," she said doubtfully, "but riding mistress teaches Ayurthian to everyone, and no one has picked it up at all. I have a knack for languages." She started to teach me right then. Once heard, always remembered is the way with languages and me. By the end of an hour, I was forming short sentences. Arida was delighted.
"Uchu ubensu evtame ogento?"
I asked. "Do you like finishing school?" She shrugged. "You don't? Is it terrible?" I asked, reverting to Kyrian. A shadow fell across my neglected sewing. Sewing mistress picked up my pillow cover and announced dramatically, 3 stitches in all this time! 3 vast, messy stitches! Like 3 teeth in a toothless gum. Go to your room and stay there until it's time for bed. No supper for you tonight." My stomach growled so loudly that the whole room must have heard it. Hattie smirked at me. She couldn't have planned better herself. I wouldn't add to her pleasure. "I'm not hungry," I announced.
"Then you may do without breakfast as well for your impertinence."
Chapter 10. A maid showed me to a corridor lined with doors. Each one was painted a different pastel color and had a card affixed to it announcing the name of the room. We passed the lime room, the daisy room, and the opal room, and stopped before the lavender room. The maid opened the door. For a moment, I forgot my hunger. I was in a cloud of light purple. Some of the purples blushed faintly pink. Others were tinted pale blue, but there was no other color. The curtains were streamers, undulating from the breeze made by the door closing behind me. Beneath my feet was a hooked rug in the design of a huge violet. In a corner stood a clay chamber pot, disguised as a decorative cabbage. The 5 beds were swathed in a gauzy fabric. The 5 bureaus were painted with wavy stripes of pale and paler lavender. I wanted to throw myself on a bed and cry about being so hungry and about everything else, but these were not beds onto which one could throw oneself. A purple chair was placed next to one of the 2 windows. I sank into it.
If I didn't succumb to starvation, I would be here for a long time, with hateful mistresses and with Hattie ordering me about. I stared out the window at Madame Edith's garden until exhaustion and hunger produced a kind of stupor in me. In a while, I slept.
Here, Ella, you can eat this. An urgent whisper pushed its way into my dream about roasted pheasant stuffed with chestnuts. Someone shook my shoulder. Wake up, Ella! Wake up!
An order. I was awake. Arita thrust a roll into my hands. It's all I could get. Eat it before the others come in. In two swallows, I ate the soft white roll. More air than sustenance, but more sustenance than I'd had in days.
Thank you. Do you sleep in here, too?
She nodded.
Where?
The door opened, and three maidens entered.
Look! Queer ducks flock together!
The speaker was the tallest pupil in the school. She pronounced her L's as Y's, mocking Arita's accent.
Esset ifibinsu asura adensa ivantme oigento?
I asked Arita. Is this how they behave at finishing school?
Atemso ifibensi asura ipiri.
Sometimes they are much worse.
Are you from Ayurtha too? The tall maiden asked me.
No, but Arita is teaching me the beautiful Ayurthian language. In Ayurthian, you are an Ibwi Unju.
It only meant tall girl. I didn't know any insults in Ayurthian. However, Arita was laughing, which made it seem the worst of epithets. I laughed too. Arita collapsed on top of me, and together we shook the purple chair.
Madam Edith, the headmistress, bustled in. Young ladies, what do I see?
Arita leaped up, but I remained seated. I couldn't stop laughing.
My chairs are not made to take such abuse. And young ladies do not sit two to a seat. Do you hear me? Ella, stop your unseemly laughter.
I stopped mid-giggle.
That's better. Since it's your first day here, I shall excuse your behavior and trust that it will have improved tomorrow.
Madam Edith turned to the others.
Into your nightdresses, young ladies. The shores of sleep are approaching.
Arita and I exchanged glances. It was very cheering to have a friend. Everyone else reached the shores of sleep, but I remained oceans away. I had been given a nightdress so covered with bows and frills that I couldn't lie flat comfortably. I slipped out of bed and opened my carpet bag. If I couldn't sleep, I could read. Madam Edith thought fear of the dark was to be expected in young ladies, so a lamp was left burning. My book opened to a letter from Mandy.
Dear Ella, this morning I baked scones. Bertha and Nathan and I will eat them for a snack before we go to bed, but I baked two extra. We'll have to divide yours and eat them too. I promised myself I wouldn't trouble you by saying how much I miss you, and see how I start? That parrot man named Simon came here today with one of his birds to give you. It speaks gnomic and elfian. He said it wasn't fine enough for the menagerie, but you might like it. He told me what to feed it. I never thought I'd be cooked to a parrot.
I wish it would stop talking once in a while. I wonder if I have a recipe for parrot stew.
Don't worry, sweet. I would never cook your present. Yesterday, you had a grander visitor and received a bigger gift than a bird. The prince himself came to see you, leading a centaur colt. When I told him you were away from home, he wanted to know where you'd gone and when you'd be back. And when he heard you were at finishing school, he was indignant. He demanded to know why you needed to be finished, since there was nothing wrong with you to start with. I couldn't answer him, because I'd like to ask that father of yours the same question. I did tell him we had nowhere to keep a growing centaur. He's a little beauty, but what can I do with him? Your prince said he'd raise him for you. He asked me to tell you the colt's name, Apple. That made me remember my manners, and I gave him his name to eat before he left with the prince. Speaking of leaving, your father departed the same day you did, said he was off to the Greenies, which I gathered was his disrespectful name for the elves, said not to expect him back any time soon. I wish you were coming home soon. Bertha and Nathan send their love, and I send mine. By the bushel, by the barrel, by the ton. From your old cook, Mandy. P.S. Drink your tonic. I closed the book and whispered to its spine, "Don't erase the letter, please." Then I drank my tonic. A centaur colt, a little beauty. If only I could see him and pet him and let him know me. The tears that hadn't come in the afternoon came now. Mandy would be desperate if she knew I hadn't eaten in 3 days, and if she knew I was under the thumb of a monster like Hattie. The next morning, music mistress led us in song and singled out my off-key voice. "Ella does not notice that there is more than one note," she told everyone. "Come here, child, sing this." She played a note on the harpsichord. I wouldn't be able to. I could never carry a tune. What would happen when I couldn't obey? I sang the wrong note. Music mistress frowned. "Higher, or we shall send you to a different school to sing with the young gentleman." She depressed the key again. My next attempt was much too high. One less covered her ears. I wished her an earache. Music mistress played again. My temples throbbed. I sang. "A little lower." I hit the note. She played another. I sang it. She played a scale. I sang every note. I beamed. I'd always wished I could sing. I sang the scale again, louder. Perfect. "That's enough, young lady. You must sing when I tell you to, and not otherwise." An hour later, dancing mistress told me to step lightly. My partner was Julia, the tall maiden who had teased Arita the night before. I pressed on her arms, using her to support my weight so that I could step lightly. "Stop that!" She pulled away. I fell. I heard giggles. Dancing mistress took Julia's place. I couldn't lean on her. I pretended my feet were balloons. I pretended the floor would crack if I didn't move lightly. We stepped. We glided. We sprang forward, jumped back. I wasn't graceful, but I didn't shake the ground. My gown was soaked with perspiration. "That's better." At lunch, manners mistress said, "Don't rap your knuckles on the table, Ella. The king would be ashamed of you." She frequently invoked King Gerald. Tables were forever safe from me. "Take small stitches, Eleanor, and don't yank the thread. It's not a rein, and you're not a coachman," sewing mistress said later in the afternoon. I stabbed myself with the needle, but my stitches shrank. It was the same every day. I dreaded new orders. The curse didn't make me change easily. I had to concentrate every second. In my mind, I repeated my commands in an endless refrain. When I awoke, I instructed myself not to bounce out of bed. Leave the nightdress for the servants to put away. At breakfast, don't blow on my porridge, and don't spit out the lumps. On our afternoon walk, don't skip, don't leap about. Once I actually spoke aloud. It was at dinner. "Don't slurp," I instructed myself. I said it softly, but a pupil seated near me heard, and she told the others. The only subjects that came easily were those taught by writing mistress, composition and ciphering. She also taught penmanship, which was the one subject in which I did not attain excellence, because writing mistress issued no orders. She taught Iorthean, but no other languages. When I told her I knew a little of the exotic tongues and wished to learn more, she gave me a dictionary of exotic speech. It became my second favorite book, after Mandy's present. Whenever I had time, I practiced the languages, especially Ogurese. The meanings were dreadful, but there was an attraction in speaking the words. They were smooth, sleek, and slithery, the way a talking snake would sound. There were words like phthisibus, delicious, sing, eat, hnjing, dinner, ifuth, taste, and new, sour. My progress in all my subjects astounded the mistresses. In my first month, I did little right. In my second, I did little wrong. And gradually, it all became natural. Light steps, small stitches, quiet voice, ramrod straight back, deep curtsies without creaking knees, no yawns, soup tilted away from me, and no slurping. But in bed, before I fell asleep, I'd imagine what I'd do if I were free of Lucinda's curse. At dinner, I'd paint lines of gravy on my face and hurl meat pasties at Manners Mistress. I'd pile Headmistress's best china on my head and walk with a wobble and a swagger till every piece was smashed.
Then I'd collect the smashed pottery and the smashed meat pasties and grind them into all my perfect stitchery. Chapter 11. Except for Arita, I had little pleasure from the society at finishing school. Only Hattie's set pretended to be friendly, and they treated me with the same oily condescension Hattie visited on me in public. They were an odious group, Hattie and the two she called her special friends, Blossom and Delicia. Blossom was the niece and sole heir to an unmarried earl. Her conversation was mostly worries that the earl would marry and have a child who would replace her as his heir. Delicia, the daughter of a duke, spoke rarely. When she did, it was to complain. The room was too drafty, the meal was ill-prepared, a housemaid had acted above her station, one of the other pupils wore rouge. The mistresses came to dislike me, too. At first, while I struggled to satisfy them and began to succeed, they made a pet of me, which I hated. But when finished behavior became my second nature, they learned I was nobody's pet. I spoke as infrequently as I could and met their eyes only when I had to. And I returned to my old game. "Sing more softly, Ella. They can hear you in Iortha." I became inaudible. "Not too soft. The rest of us would like to hear your sweet tones." I sang too loud again, although not so much as before. Music mistress had to spend a quarter hour inching me along to the desired volume. "Lift your feet, young ladies. This is a spirited gavotte." My leg shot up above my waist, and so on. It was a tiresome game, but I had to play it or feel a complete puppet. Hattie didn't tell anyone about my obedience. When she had an order for me, she'd tell me to meet her in the garden after supper, when no one else was near. On the first such occasion, she instructed me to pick a bouquet for her. Luckily, she didn't know I was goddaughter to a fairy cook. I picked the most fragrant blooms, then ran to the herb garden, hoping to find something useful. Ethelwort was my preference. If I found it, Hattie would have an itchy rash on her face for a week. Most of the herbs were the ordinary sort, but as I turned to leave, I spotted a sprig of bogweed. Taking care not to breathe its scent, I plucked it and placed it next to a rose. Hattie was delighted with the flowers and buried her face in them. "They're sublime, but what..." As the scent of the bogweed worked on her, her smile faded, and her expression became vacant. "What would make you stop giving me orders?" she answered in a flat voice. "If you stopped obeying them." Of course, I had wasted a question, and I had no idea how long the bogweed scent would last. But as long as it lasted, I could ask her anything, and she would answer honestly. "What else would stop you?" I asked quickly.
"Nothing," she thought. "My death. No likely release from that quarter."
"What orders do you plan to give me?"
"I don't plan."
"Why do you hate me? You never admired me." "Do you admire me?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
"You're pretty. And brave."
She envied me. I was amazed. "What do you fear?" I asked.
"Ogres, bandits, drowning, becoming ill, climbing mountains, mice, dogs, cats, birds, horses, spiders, worms, tunnels, I staffed her. She was afraid of everything.
"What do you want most in the world?"
"To be queen." A rabbit queen. Only I would obey her.
Her face was changing, resuming its usual expression of gleeful malice. I tried one more question. "What are your secrets?" She didn't answer. Just tugged cruelly on a handful of my hair. Her eyes lost their dull cast. "Why am I standing here?" She looked down at her flowers but didn't sniff them again.
"Oh, yes, what a good lady-in-waiting to bring me such a beautiful bouquet," she frowned. "But one scent is not sweet. Take it out."
I removed the bogweed and ground it under my foot. If I had thought of it, I could have asked her how she could be defeated. Hattie's orders were chiefly chores. I think she lacked the imagination to devise more interesting commands. I brushed her clothes, cleaned her boots, rubbed her neck where it ached. Several times I had to sneak into the pantry and steal cookies. On one occasion I had to clip her toenails.
Do you rub brine into your feet? I asked, trying not to choke.
I took revenge whenever I could. Spiders and mice from Madame Edith's cellar found their way into Hattie's bed. I'd stay awake at night and wait for the satisfying shriek. And so it went. Hattie issued commands and I retaliated. But there was no balance. Hattie was always ahead. She had the power. She held the whip. Arita was my only comfort. We ate our meals side by side. We sewed together. In our dancing lessons, we were partners. I told her about Frel and Mandy and Char. She told me about her parents, who kept an inn. They weren't wealthy, another reason she was unpopular. When she left school, she would use her accomplishments to help them. She was kinder than anyone I'd ever known. When Julia, the tall wench, ate too many grapes from Madame Edith's arbor and was sick all night, Arita nursed her, although Julia's friends slept soundly. I helped, but only for Arita's sake. My nature was not so forgiving. In the garden one evening, I found myself telling Arita about Mother. Before she died, we used to climb trees like this one. I rested a hand on the trunk of a low-branching oak. We'd go way up and sit as quiet as could be. Then we'd toss twigs or acorns at anyone who passed beneath. "What happened to her?" she asked. "Don't tell me if you don't want to." "I don't mind." When I finished telling her, she sang an Eorthian morning song. "Hard farewell, with no greeting to come. Sad farewell, when love is torn away. Long farewell, till death dies. But the lost one is with you. Her tenderness strengthens you. Her gaiety uplifts you. Her honor purifies you. More than memory, the lost one is found." Arita's voice was as smooth as syrup and as rich as gnome's gold. I cried steady tears like rain. And like rain, they brought ease. "You have a beautiful voice," I said when I could speak. "We Eorthians are all singers, but singing mistress says my voice is too husky. Hers is thin as a string, and yours is perfect." A bell rang in the house, calling us in to prepare for bed. "Is my nose red from crying?" I asked. "A little." "I don't want the others to see. I'll stay out a while longer." "Manners mistress will be angry," I shrugged. "She'll only tell me I've disgraced the king." "I'll stay with you. I can watch your nose and tell you when it's not red anymore. Pay attention, don't let your eyes wander." I wrinkled the feature. Arita giggled. "I won't." "Manners mistress will ask what we're doing out here." I was laughing too. "I'll tell her I'm watching your nose. And I'll tell her I'm wrinkling it. She'll want to know what the king would think of our behavior. I'll tell her the queen watches every night while he wrinkles his nose 7 times. The bell rang again. "Your nose isn't red now," Arita said. We ran for the house and met Manners mistress at the door, on her way to search for us. The sight of her set us off again. "Young ladies, go to your room. What would the king say?" In the hall, still giggling, we met Hattie. "Having a nice time?" "We were," I answered. "I won't keep you then. But tomorrow, Ella, you must spend some time in the garden with me." "You shouldn't associate with the lower orders like that wench from Eorthia," she said the next evening. "Arita is a higher order than you are, and I choose my own friends." My dear, I hate to cause you grief, but you must end your friendship with her." Chapter 12 Hattie returned to the house, but I stayed outside. I watched her leave, hating her way of walking. A mince combined with a waddle. She stopped to pick a flower and lifted to her nose, posturing for me. I sat on a bench and stared down at the pebbled walk. In all the times I'd imagined the misery she could inflict on me, I'd never imagined this. I thought of injuries, and I'd imagined terrible embarrassment, but I'd never thought of this kind of hurt. Arita was in her room now, waiting to give me a lesson in Eorthian. I remained seated. I couldn't face her.
Was there a way to stop being her friend without hurting her? I could pretend I had suddenly become mute, so I wouldn't be able to talk to her. But in that circumstance, she'd be my friend as much as ever. She'd talk to me, and we'd invent a sign language, which would be great fun. And that wouldn't be ending our friendship, so the curse wouldn't let me do it. Besides, a mistress would be sure to say, "Speak, Ella," and I would have to. I could announce I'd taken a vow of loneliness, but Arita would be hurt that I'd taken such a vow. If only Mother hadn't forbidden me to tell about the curse. But then again, explaining would be an act of friendship, which the curse also wouldn't allow. The bell rang, calling us to bed. I was late again, but tonight there was no Arita to joke with about our tardiness. In our room, she sat on my bed, completing a letter for writing mistress. "Where were you? I've been reviewing the imperative." "I'm tired," I said, not answering the question. Perhaps I did look tired, or troubled, because she didn't press me. She only patted my arm and said, "We can study imperatives tomorrow." In bed, I didn't want to sleep. I wanted to savor the last few hours before I had to hurt her. "Sleep on, Arita. Be my friend for one more night." A long vigil lay ahead. I pulled out my magic book. It opened to a letter from Dame Olga to her daughters. "My sweet darlings, your poor mother is desolate without you. I attended a cotillion last night at the palace. I wore my wine-colored taffeta gown and my ruby pendant, but it was for naught. The company was thin because King Gerald is away, although Prince Charmant was there. That charming man Sir Peter wasn't there either. I was desolate. I understand he's off traveling and becoming richer, I imagine. I wish him well, and will be first to pay my respects on his return." 3 pages followed, describing Dame Olga's social calendar and her wardrobe. In closing, she remembered she had daughters and was writing to them. "I hope both of you are eating well, to keep up your strength. Olive, pray remember not to eat Madame Edith's flowers. If you were to sicken or die, I should be desolate. Hattie, I hope you have found a trustworthy servant to dress your hair. Madame E. promised it could be arranged. I expect the two of you are..."